welcome to the Create Something Awesome Today podcast, where it's all about educating and motivating creative pros and entrepreneurs from around the world with simple and easy to implement ideas. And of course, helping you create something awesome today. And now, welcome your host. He is the founder of Awesome Creator Academy, a YouTube educator, and the biggest Star Wars nerd you'll ever meet, Roberto Blake.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Create Something Awesome Today podcast. This is your host, Roberto Blake, helping you create something awesome today. So we have a great guest on today's show. I'm trying to actually bring more guests on for 2018. This is something that you guys have asked for, and it's something that I'm really excited about. Today, I have my good friend, Kathy Close Guest, who is a best-selling author, a public speaker, a marketing consultant that helps people stop being boring, which is also the title of her book. And we're going to have a conversation around the current state of corporate culture, because we're both exiles or refugees from corporate America. We're survivors. We're not going to give up. So that's a lot of fun. You guys are really going to enjoy today's show. Speaking of which, today's show is brought to you by, well, me. Today's show is brought to you by awesomecreatoracademy.com, which is my online education platform, mentoring group. We also have a lot of interesting products that we've just released, including the YouTube Starter Kit. If you go to the show notes, you'll find a discount for that. So if you're somebody who's trying to build your business or your brand, leverage YouTube, but you suck at Photoshop and you're not a wizard like me, then we've got over 100 templates in the YouTube Starter Kit at a wonderful price. So you might even find a little discount code if you look in the show notes. So check that out at awesomecreatoracademy.com. See if there's anything we can do to help you create something awesome today.
And now, this week's special guest, bursting with ideas and ready to share them with you.
So, Kathy, I've been wanting to have you on the show forever, and it's great to finally have you here. Why don't you tell the audience a little bit more about yourself?
Yay! Well, it's great to be here. And actually, I just have to say, like, I would jump in there and sing that Destiny's Child song with you because I love it so much. copyrights and all, we can't do that.
Copyright strikes.
Copyrights and all. But yeah, no, thanks for having me on the show. Just the sort of the brief Reader's Digest version is, as Roberta pointed out, just came out of corporate, spent 15 years in corporate America running marketing. When I left, I was a senior director of marketing. And it was my job to make sure that all the stories and all the communications in the company were consistent. It was a high-tech company. And while I was working in tech, same number of years, I'd been doing, you know, 5-6 nights a week doing comedy and performing comedy. And I come from storytelling both in a corporate context. I also come from storytelling on a stage, on the sketch stage, on the improv stage, and on the stand-up comedy stage. And I've done several one-woman shows written and produced myself. And so I wanted to be able to take storytelling in a really human way from the stage and really combine it with storytelling the way that we do it in companies. And so I kind of left to be able to take these separate worlds and really combine them and just sort of have that ba-bam, you know, effect when you combine two cool things.
No, I think that's awesome. I think people underestimate the power of remixing. I think that they underestimate what it means to combine things from different worlds or different genres. I think they're afraid of perceptions that could be around that. But I've seen that it's wildly successful when people do these kind of things. I mean, look at someone like, whether you agree with his politics or not, look at the success of someone like Bill Maher, who combined both politics and comedy. And if you don't feel him, look at Stephen Colbert and his success with that. Look at John Oliver. Okay. Look at, formerly, who am I thinking of? Who had The Daily Show before Colbert? Why am I spacing on his name all of a sudden?
John Stewart.
Yeah, how can I forget John Stewart?
That's right.
Blasphemy.
Yeah. So it feels like he's been gone forever.
John, come back. Baby, come back.
Yeah.
But copyright.
That's right. That's all we can sing. That's it. You get 7 seconds. 7 second rule.
Right. So what's one of the things when you were in corporate America? I have experience with this myself. When you were in corporate America and you were on the come up, what was one of the biggest challenges and one of the biggest barriers to your career escalation? And like, what did you find so unsatisfying about your job in corporate America? But also pivot tell us also what you found most rewarding, because again, we're not trying to throw working the 9-to-5 job or climbing the corporate ladder under the bus so much as we're trying to help have a positive conversation about the need for culture shift and change to produce more productive, more satisfied, happier workers who, you know, don't quit, don't tank their department, you know, just because of politics, or don't tank their department because they're depressed. You get what I'm saying.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, for sure. And, you know, you might as well, if you're in corporate America, make the most of it while you're there and get as much learning as you can while you're there. So the thing for me, and you'll identify this, and I think your audience, you know, the folks out there, the good folks that are listening will identify, because if you're a creative type, you always want to push that creative envelope. We're all about taking risks, and we know there's so much marketing that is dry and dull. And I think one of the challenges that I had was I always knew that there was a more lively way, a fun way, even using humor. And I wanted to bring more of my comedy writing skills to the table. And it was always a challenge to, in corporate America, to get people to say yes. Now, sometimes I got forgiveness versus permission. That only gets you so far.
Where do you feel the resistance came from?
You know, it comes from fear. It's usually at the top. It comes from fear that says, well, what if we fail? And what if our customers don't like it? And what I found was, and more often than not, that fear was unfounded. And it comes from a fear of, gosh, you know, what if we fail? However, what I found, what I discovered is that when we were successful and I was able to push the envelope, it is because I was able to rally our best customers and run copy by them and run an ad by them or a campaign before we launched it and get feedback. And if I took our best, most successful customers who accounted for, they were our ideal customers, the ones who spent a lot of money with us. And if I got their buy-in, it was much easier for me. And here's a suggestion for everybody listening. It was much easier for me to then go to my boss. I reported directly into the president and I'd say, look, our three top customers really like this and made them laugh. And I think they are our ideal customer. We need to be designing campaigns for them. So if they like this, chances are it will work. And that actually got me worked, you know, more often than it didn't. And so I found a way to combat sort of the conservatism by just saying, look, our customers have given it a thumbs up and I think this could really work. So that was a challenge, but also a way that I tried to navigate the system and work within the system so that, you know, if it wasn't me and they wouldn't listen to me, which they should have, but if they wouldn't listen to me, at the very least, you know, the executives can't ignore what the best customers are saying. And I found that
exactly.
You know, yeah.
You can't ignore the data that you get in terms of real human feedback. And by the way, when Kathy talks about, for context, because we're also talking about the fact that, like, Kathy worked in Silicon Valley, when we're talking about conservatism, and I guess we can actually pivot to that a little bit later, we're not talking about the political schism, no. Especially in Silicon Valley, which is like branded as ironically very liberal politically. But you'd be surprised, because at the core, when we say conservative, we're not talking about political. We're talking about behavioral psychology in terms of the risk versus reward factor of being more risk adverse, i.e. the fact that I'm considered a frugal person, as Kathy well knows. And I count coppers. My hero growing up was Scrooge McDuck. And so I'm fiscally... Like, fiscal conservatism is another thing that's politicized, but it's actually a more of an economic principle, yeah. And more of an approach to how you value money and how you have to validate risk and how you apply
right.
metrics. I mean, it gets very, right. I don't want to give like an econ class, but like right. essentially it comes down to, I use the 10 and 30% rule of, for any given situation, don't spend more than 10 to 30% of what you have available as your maximum cap. And then I do things like assign and allocate things like for my equipment. Like, I actually have a literal hardline equipment spending budget like every year. And I always go over by about 15 or 20%, but I already knew I was going to do that. I should just move the goalpost, right? But I don't, because it keeps me disciplined. So I, again, I wanted to just add that layer of context to people, yes. because It's 2017, 2018. I know exactly what world we live in. I know that all it takes is one word in a sentence for people to go down a rabbit hole, which
that's right.
Again, we could talk about that too. You have experience with that in corporate America too, right?
Absolutely. And no, and I'm glad you actually framed it because you're absolutely correct. I definitely meant conservatism meant more in risk aversion of trying new things and humor and our customers are too risk averse and they're too old fashioned. They won't like it.
Is that what's perceived as professional or branded as professional?
Yes. Here's the sad reality is that we look at anything humor and we go, it can't be serious. If it's funny, it can't be serious. And that is absolutely false. It's such a false assumption. What we found was if you can make people laugh, you can make people smile, if you can be exciting and interesting and not boring, you are more likely to capture people's attention. And so it's the opposite, right? You lose more. Think of all the money that you're flushing down the toilet with these million-dollar campaigns that companies are doing, but it's so boring, nobody's reading them. Response rates are low, open rates are low. You're not getting ahead. So if you're going to spend the kind of money and muscle and time and resources to execute a campaign, why not make it interesting? What have you got to risk? And what we found was, more often than not, when we did things that were lively and fun and we challenged assumptions, we had far better open rates, far better engagement rates, far better lead generation. We just, by all metrics, we did better. So I really want people to challenge. If you're making an assumption that you think, no, we can't do it that way, I think creativity says be willing to challenge some of those old assumptions.
You know, it's been proven too. I mean, look at even like old school marketing, right? Like look at a brand like Trojan Condoms and and I'm being very serious about this. Like look at Trojan Condoms and how they leveraged humor around something as serious and as important a decision as sex and safe sexes. And look at the tremendous risk they took, and their brand is known for it. And it disproportionately worked. They're the only brand you really think of in that arena a lot of times. They're the market leader. They have the brand awareness. And how did that happen? It happened because they interjected humor into a very serious thing, a taboo thing. Sex in Western culture, it has a lot of taboos around it, but you'll find that they are the brand that comes to mind. It's become part of our pop culture and our lexicon.
Yeah.
Right. So think about that. Look at what Red Bull did in the energy drink market. And again, they are the leading thing top of mind when it comes to energy drinks. Like all we think about is Red Bull. Mm-hmm. They're part of our pop culture now too, as a result of that. Mm-hmm. You only that by taking tremendous risk, and you only do that by making an emotional appeal to the consumer and being relatable.
Right. Well said. Well said. And a lot of times when you find yourself with a situation or a topic, even in B2B that might be serious, that, you know, if you find a way to inject something interesting, and it doesn't have to be funny, but if you can make it interesting and less boring, you actually can move the conversation. Because if you're coming at an old conversation the same way that's boring, nobody wants to talk about it. And I I've said this before, Roberto, and I talk about it, in the book, and I'm not trying to sell a book here, but I think it's an important point.
I'll plug your book.
Well, I appreciate it. But it's really an important point, which is I think what people don't get is boring is a tax on your audience's time and attention, and they will not pay it. And I think we have to start thinking about what does boring do to us? It actually hurts us, because if we're spending money and time and resources and we're not getting our messages through, we failed. Because here's the thing, in an increasingly complex world with so much coming at your audience, think about your own patterns, your own content consumption patterns, right? We're all just besieged with stuff. If you're coming at your audience with boring, dull messages, they're like, no more, no more. Their cup is full. So you're putting a tax on them and asking them to pay it. You're asking them to take their time and attention, which is precious little today, and figure out what the hell you're even saying in your campaign. And people increasingly will not do it in a busy world. So you've got to pay that tax. And the way that you pay the tax, not your audience, is to do the creative heavy lifting up front to make sure your messages are clear and crisp and compelling and getting through.
I 110% agree, obviously. And, that's what I try to accomplish. Someone we follow and that we admire, Gary Vaynerchuk uses the phrase constantly, day trading attention. From your perspective, what does day trading attention mean?
Oh my gosh, we are constantly, that's a great phrase and I couldn't agree more. It's like we are constantly, you know, short on attention. We might short sell. It's like we're living in a world where we might be doing one thing and something else grabs our attention. And it's like, oh, squirrel, there's a nut. And constantly, and we're living in this world of the attention's going to flow to the easiest, quickest, hottest thing that I can get my arms around. So he's right. Put five things in front of your audience at any one time. The thing that they have to work harder with brain cycles to decode and figure out, guess what they're going to do? Bye. Close that window. They're not going to give it any attention because the other things in front of them are easier for them to process. So he's absolutely right. We're day trading attention and attention.
So you need to grab that attention because it's a real commodity. It's a real asset because time is the asset. But then you have to, you also have to be wildly accessible. And that's something, you know, that I've been trying to help people crack the nut on is being accessible. And my thesis of it has been leveraging content platforms and social platforms. But we get this narrative, especially in corporate, of, well, you can't be everywhere and you can't do everything. You know that I don't necessarily believe that's true because I don't think people have audited it. I don't think people have audited themselves properly because I've learned that it takes 20 minutes out of your day to be really good at Instagram, and it's just 20 minutes. And that's one. You can use and do another 10 minutes variation of that without spamming and be in Snapchat if you want to be, but I would choose Instagram over Snapchat. You can spread out 15 minutes a day in Twitter and it'd be wildly practical. And it takes 5 minutes if you go live or 10 minutes if you go live to do a piece of Facebook or YouTube content if you want to go live versus editing. So how is it that people don't have the time to be in multiple platforms? How do you not have the time to do literally a 60-minute tip or question of the day in LinkedIn video natively from your phone every day? If it meant showing up every day in LinkedIn, you could literally allocate 5 minutes to doing that in a meaningful way. I just don't believe that people, especially in corporate, are auditing an efficient way to be truly omnipresent in places that make sense to have attention, because you'll hear people say this, and I want your opinion on this, that we'll go where your audience are, but I don't care what your demographics are, because for the people who are Gen X and boomers, 80% of them, there's data on this, 80% of the boomers and Gen Xers that are on the internet are on YouTube for one thing. And they're certainly on other platforms. Women over 35 are the fastest growing demographic in Instagram, not millennials. There's an audience for you, for your product or service in every single platform. It's a matter of, are you willing to be there more than your competitor to siphon as much market share and value and deliver on value? And so I kind of want your thoughts on that thesis.
Yeah, you know, it's an issue. And you're right. You're talking about conventional wisdom and, you know, challenging conventional wisdom, because you're right. The conventional wisdom has always been, well, your audience won't be everywhere. So pick where they're at. And I do think there is some truth to that. You know, for example, if your audience is women over 35, well, you should know where they hang out and get their information. What platforms are they likely to use? Let's be honest, they're probably not on Snapchat. However,
or how they use it.
However, I also think it's really important to challenge that conventional wisdom, because every once in a while, it's important to go, really? Well, let's take another look at that, because we could be wrong. I mean, it used to be people thought that, boomers and people of a certain age weren't on Facebook, but we know one of the fastest growing demos on Facebook are, you know, grandparents, right? Why? Because that's how they keep in touch with their friends and their family. And so to sort of
see the pictures of the grandkids.
Exactly. And so it would be a mistake to dismiss them because it defies conventional wisdom. So I think you're right in the sense of, look, you do need to know where to put the preponderance of your focus, because if you're scattered, you're not effective. But what you're suggesting, and I like the way you frame it, and I think it's true, is that you don't need tons of time. You just need to allocate time wisely. So if you're going to do Instagram, figure out what works. Now, that's not to say that you aren't going to try some things and it's not going to work. Look, I've tried tons of stuff on Instagram and I'm still trying. And I've noticed that some stuff has worked really well. Some stuff, not so much. But you have to take the risks and try things. And don't be afraid. You know, if something doesn't work, something else will. So use your time wisely. And I would also say, if it's not working for you, then figure out why it's not working for you. But you're right. I do think that each platform is really different. And now is the time to figure out, okay, LinkedIn's changed. What do I got to do differently on LinkedIn? Instagram's different. What do I got to do different on Instagram? And
context of platform is so important.
So important. You can't cut and paste anymore, man. That just doesn't work.
I believe the big problem is not, like, I think people do very poorly in content strategy, which is, again, a big focus of what I do with coaching and consulting, both for individuals and with brands. And also the things that I teach for free, like on platforms like YouTube and the articles that I've been writing on Medium. Mm-hmm. But hashtag plugging myself. But like but not shamelessly, because again, it's value that I'm literally giving away for free at this point, right. Just like this show. But the reason that it's important to me is because, here's one I want to hit you with. You have been a consultant and you've been in the corporate space. Let me ask you something. A lot of people might think about content strategy, but have they thought about communication strategy? Because content strategy is just about the execution in that platform. Like, what content are we going to do? What's our release schedule, et cetera, et cetera. How are we going to track and measure conversions? How are we going to frame all of this, blah, blah, blah. But what they're not thinking about is a higher level above that, a communication strategy for saying, what's our tonality, what's our focus, and what's the user intent at each platform and in each medium? What are the strengths of how we do things in an audio form, a video form, a print form, photos and graphics, the written word, and then which platforms are we executing what on, and what strengths and what's the context and quirks of that platform, what's the tech say, but also what's the user base? Emotionally driven content, Instagram. Things that also could be product-based do very well on Instagram. If you have something that's more service-based and family-related, I would say Facebook is a really great platform for that, because like we said, older demographic, sometimes more affluent demographic. But if you want to reach the youth, Snapchat and Instagram are very viable there. If you need to get feedback and data in almost a real-time fashion or do customer service, Twitter is probably one of the best platforms for that. Demonstrating and showing your work or your knowledge, YouTube. I mean, there's like, I don't think that a lot of people, whether they're corporate or independently, are really framing each of these platforms based on a communication strategy that looks at tone, user intent, the quirks of the platform, the culture of the platform, and what people go there to spend time on and what's acceptable there. Yeah. I think that people, when I see people, and it's no offense to anybody, and sometimes it's a practical way, when I see people do things like restream and broadcast on all platforms, if you're doing certain things, that makes sense. But I think people are just doing a lot of this stuff ad hoc, and I think there's a lot of copy and paste. I mean, what are your thoughts?
So you ask such great questions. It really is. Listen, it's a million-dollar question. I'm so glad you asked it, Roberto, because so many people focus on content strategy. I mean, if I had a dollar for every time people went, content marketing, content marketing, content marketing, it's like the new buzzword. But what...
I'm going to take the entire word. I'm going to take the entire results page of YouTube. Watch me.
And seriously, it's ridiculous. And here's the thing, because you hit it on the head. It does no good if we actually have a process and we're all in Buffer and Hootsuite and we've got all our layers and we're executing and we've got our timed social media channel distribution, all that stuff. But we've never thought about the communication message we're trying to say. So I you're right. That's the one thing that I think people don't do enough of, is you can be firing on all these cylinders and getting content out there, but your content is disconnected because it doesn't tie back to a larger Who are you? What's your story in the world? What's the one thing you want people to know about you and your brand? What do you want to help people do? What's your big message in the world? And I think what people don't spend enough time is, forget just by channel, because you're right, there's a whole other layer of understanding what an Instagram strategy is, and that's very visual versus having a podcast strategy, all these other things. But what people don't spend enough time on, and it's not just, smaller brands and individual brands, it's company brands too. They don't step back and go, what's our big purpose story? What's our vision in the world? And how are we taking that story and making it come to life across each of these channels? Do people know who we are and what we're all about? And we just don't spend enough time on that. And I find that too many content managers are so steeped in the technical aspects of execution, Roberto, that they're not stepping back and looking at the big strategic question, which is, who are we? Why does anybody care? What's our big story? And if we can only say one thing to our audience, would they know who we are? Could they pick our content out of a lineup? I mean, do we have a unique voice in the world? And most people just don't spend enough time asking those questions, and they're super important.
Do you think it's because in corporate culture and in marketing land, we see this with a lot of our friends and contemporaries, not calling them out. I don't believe in call out culture, which has become a new thing, right? Or maybe it's an old thing, but social media is just scaling it. I believe in that. Cause I think people have always been in our arena in business, in entrepreneurship, in professional circles. Mm-hmm. There's elitism and there's cattiness, and I hate it. I think that's part of one of the other things. We try to escape that from corporate, but we then find it in the world of consulting as well, to be in the world of speaking, even to be another thing. So you never really get away from it. You get out, they keep pulling you back in, right? But I've always theorized that part of the reason for what you're saying is because corporate culture rewards inefficiencies and bad behavior if you can look like you're busy enough. And if you just do things that produce numbers, the context of those numbers almost becomes irrelevant. I lived through it. I watched it. One of the things I'll say about like 9-to-5 culture and why it really needs to die. Like, I want to beat it in the face with a shovel and bury it in the woods somewhere. That's really aggressive, but it's the truth. It's one of the things that needs to die. 9-to-5 culture needs to die. And I'll tell you why. 9-to-5 culture does not reward efficiency and productivity. Primary example, everything should be task-based. Everything should be task-based so that it rewards efficiency, because if I've now learned, like if I accomplish something, let me flip it a different way, because I'm an employer now. Let me flip it a different way. I prefer task-based things because human behavior dictates that something takes the time that you allocate to it. And if you put someone on an hourly wage versus on an end result-based or a results-based wage or performance-based wage, they will take longer to do something because they're trying to rack up billable hours, which doesn't produce any efficiency for you, doesn't get you to the finish line any sooner, and your time is the most valuable thing. If time is so valuable, then don't pay people for time, pay them for performance, because if you're paying them for time, they'll rack up more hours and the quality will be the same. They'll just drag out the process because that is where they're getting the most money. But if you say, here's the price, they will do it in the most efficient, expedient way possible, which gets you to a result faster. And if there need to be adjustments, revisions, refinements, you get to that sooner too, because they're trying to move on to the next thing that they can bill for. And that is wildly practical, and it rewards efficiency and it incentivizes. It's just human behavior, right? But if you make someone run out the clock and they know that they don't get to knock off early, why would they work any harder in the period of time? What, for you just throw more work on their pile? And that's the reason that I think the culture is broken and things need to change. And so it's why I believe when I work with people, a lot of times I don't pay on an hourly model. I pay on a results-based model. I pay on performance. I pay by the task. And it's worked out better for me for getting a result faster, so I have less anxiety. Every minute that a task that I assign someone isn't done, my chest hurts. Okay. That's what living with anxiety is like. In entrepreneurship, I don't know why I decided to be an entrepreneur when I have anxiety and depression, because like that seems really counterintuitive. It's just that at least it's up on me, and at least I'm the bad boss now. And it's like, I don't like my boss. I can actually punch my boss in the mouth this time. In corporate, I don't have that option. Right. So I think that that's where I stand on it, is I feel that there's a part of the culture that rewards bad behavior in the form of like measure performance metrics and KPIs all matter. I'm not going to pretend that they don't. Right. I just think that there are better ways that are slightly less comfortable to be more productive and efficient. And success, you have to move away from comfort to live in success. It's like, you know, success is, you know, an investment and commitment. It's like buying a home versus comfort is sitting there renting. So, I mean, that's just how I feel about it.
Yeah. No, well said. I mean, and I laugh because you're right. It's like, I love that you're so honest, refreshingly honest about like how unglamorous sometimes it is to be an entrepreneur, because yeah, it's like, you know, it will drive your anxiety because at the end of the day, you're responsible for everything. But
everything's my fault.
Your fault. Everything. And there's nobody else to blame, but you look in a mirror. But I think you said something really powerful, and I think it's so true. First of all, I'll say I think you're right on the efficiency thing, although I think there's a huge difference, and I believe you'd agree with this, and that this is what you're saying, is there's a big difference between efficiency and effectiveness. And sometimes we try to make everything efficient, but we're systematizing the wrong stuff. Like garbage in, garbage out to me. And I can't tell you how many people come to me and, oh, you know, we've got these systems for content marketing, but their content is garbage. So they're not getting good ROI. And it's not because they don't have the right tools and systems. It's because their content sucks. And that's hard to and that's hard to say, but it's not compelling. It has no human.
Oh, yeah. You're scaling something that sucks. Congratulations.
Exactly. You're scaling disease. Nobody wants.
Ooh, I could write an article. Stop scaling stuff that sucks.
Exactly. Because scaling crappy stuff gets you crappy results, you know? So, you know, I think we spend all this time on efficiency, but we totally put effectiveness of great content on the back burner. And I'm not talking about, I can make anything efficient. I can throw technology at stuff, but if I'm not having great, compelling human stories and content that motivates and people care about, it really doesn't matter. And you're right. And then the second thing I think is that probably the best way that I heard about it, heard this described, is I was speaking at a conference, a branding conference, and I met a guy there from PepsiCo. And his job was to
be a sugar water salesman.
Yes. And he said, Kathy, the best way I can describe it, he said this to me at lunch, and it was the best analogy I heard. He said, look, innovation in a company is like a disease in the body, and the body gets fearful and works up antibodies to go fight the disease, because that's how innovation works in corporations. It's scared of anything that is innovative or different, and that's
because that disrupts the status quo, and the status quo is comfortable and measurable, and you know,
amen.
It's there.
Amen. So what does the body do? The corporate body wants to put down the rebellion, the disease. And so it wants to put down the disease. And so it sees innovation as these foreign antibodies and bodies that want to take over and corrupt the body. And it puts it down.
New headline. Disruption isn't a disease.
Exactly. And I thought it was the most brilliant analogy I'd ever heard. And that's why the bigger the company, sometimes the harder it is to innovate, because we have too much at stake systems wise to be disrupted. And we think, oh God, the C-suite says, oh, we can't afford disruption. But then you know what it tells everybody? Go be innovative. And everyone's like, what are you saying? You don't want innovation. You say you do, but you don't. So I think it's really a couple things have to happen here, is that we have to start thinking differently and in empowering people to be innovative and creatively innovative, and really create the systems to back that up and reward that behavior. And we have to reward effectiveness, not just efficiency. You know, because you and I know scaling crappy content, scaling crappy stuff still gets crappy results.
Do you know what the value of people like you and I are as consultants? Hashtag not a plug, hashtag kind of a plug. The value of consultants, besides the specificity of like strategy, is that consultants aren't beholden to being an employee, and they don't have to be polite. They don't have to be politically correct. Mm-hmm. A consultant comes in and can whip you in the shape. A consultant gets in the ring with you and punches you in the mouth so you learn how to tuck your chin and how to dodge. I believe that. It's like having a personal trainer. It's like, okay, the world is coming for you. The world is coming for you. It's going to be relentless. It's going to keep punching. It's going to try to punch through your skull. The difference is I'm wearing gloves so that I don't destroy you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, I'm not going easy on you, but I'm not trying to take you out. But I am going to knock you out. Mm-hmm. I'm just not going to take you out. The world might take you out. I'm going to make sure that doesn't happen, and I can't go easy on you.
Yeah.
And so that's the thing that I think, you know, but I also think that because, you know, of the money involved, sometimes I do feel that some people coddle their clients, especially corporate clients, because they write really big checks. And, you know, I think that It was a Game of Thrones reference. Sir Davos in Game of Thrones, he was the Hand of the King, like the royal advisor, the Grand Vizier, if you will, or like the COO. And he said that sometimes loyal service means telling harsh truths.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's so true. And I can get all nerdy and Shakespearean here. And that was the role of the wise fool. If you're like, I'm a Shakespeare nerd, I love Shakespeare. And the role of the right hand, you know, person, if you will, to the king was always the jester. Well, why was that? Because the jester could say some pretty like hard stuff, but cloak it in humor so that the king was more likely to listen. And if you read King Lear,
honey, the medicine.
You bet it was to make the medicine go down. And in King Lear, the only one who calls King Lear out on his S is the court jester. And he's the wise fool. And in all of Shakespeare's, you read all of his work, there's a stock archetype, which is the wise fool. Now, wise fool's job is to say to the king, hey, man, you're wrong. But does it in parody and satire, so the king laughs.
You know, the people who make you feel comfortable are a danger to you to go speak Shakespeare on you? Iago. Iago. The people, Iago, the person who makes you feel comfortable, makes you feel secure, builds you up, makes you feel safe, is the biggest threat to you. And it may not even be a matter of conspiring against you or whispering in your ear in the form of Iago. It's just that you're not going to find success and comfort. They're incompatible. Mm-hmm. They really are. And it's always, I think that, like, you know, and that sounds extreme, but so let me bring it back. I'll go do an 80-20 rule on that. I think that if you have to decide whether you're going to be 80% comfortable and then take, you know, 20% ambitious risk, and that's a more conservative way of approaching it, the more zealous route is to, which is more entrepreneurial, is to go, I'll take 20% comfort and go to 80% of innovation, disruption, and risk, and put things on the line and use unconventional methods, deploy unconventional tactics, experiment, and, you know, take leaps of faith, if you will. I think that that's what's the difference between being much more entrepreneurial if it's a scale. I would say that it's the difference of the flip of the 80-20.
Mm-hmm. No, it's a really good, I think it's a great way to look at it. At some point, you've got to figure out what is successful so you can replicate it, but you always have to have some percent of your time dedicated to experimentation. And I think that's what makes an entrepreneurial mindset. And I think that is what can be in a corporate culture, yet sometimes is missing because the corporate.
I think you need an entrepreneur like department. I think part of what would change corporate culture is, like, instead of just R&D, like, you actually need a department of innovation. I think in corporate America that their only job is to experiment and break stuff, and they have a free hand to do that with some finite, very small, like, lines they can't really cross. And that's it, because, you know, you got to give people some borders, because, like, having a blank canvas is wildly intimidating and impractical sometimes. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, you give them lines so they can color outside of them. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So I think that would definitely help. Mm-hmm. Because then, you know, you have them wargaming, you have them trying to break things, you have them challenging things and questions. And so it's the person you've given permission to throw a punch every now and again.
Yes, I think it is. I think you know, creativity does like some degree of constraints, but give them some guidelines and have a department whose job is, I love it, to break stuff. I think we don't break stuff enough in companies. We're so playing it safe and we get into a rhythm. However, somebody else will come along and disrupt us. There'll be an outside force, another company. So I'm a big believer we should disrupt ourselves before somebody else.
Gary says put yourself out of business.
Absolutely.
Or somebody else will.
The biggest success, you know how I know I'm successful? I had one client for 4 years. At the end of 4 years, they kept saying, well, we want you to take a job with us. And they actually offered me a job. And I said, you don't need me anymore. And that's a good thing. You've now learned how to hunt for yourself, how to fish for yourself. We've transferred that knowledge internally. You can bring me back anytime you want for a workshop and a refresher, but you're kind of learning on your own now, and you have transferred that, and you've done it, and you've scaled. And that's how I know my job is done and you're successful. And you do want to put yourself out of business, because, you know, that's... you're not moving on and helping them any if they're completely needy on you all the time. And I think that's exactly it. Be willing to put yourself out of business. Be willing to prove yourself wrong. Be willing to disrupt yourself.
And I have the sensei model of like entrepreneurship. A lot of people ask me, like, they tell me, like, you're training your future competition on how to take money out of your pockets. And I go, yeah, that's assuming they could actually do it.
Right.
And it's like, let me look at it another way. I'm grooming my future hires. I'm training and building an ecosystem that will produce my successor. Like, that's wildly practical. That's the dojo model. Mm-hmm. Like, so I, like, for me, and you know this about me because you have context on me as a friend,
yeah,
is you know that I embrace a lot of Eastern philosophy, and that growing up a military brat, you know, I have a diverse perspective. I didn't get to travel as much of the world, but I had it brought to me, because when you're in a military family, what the education we get in the military base is to prepare us to be deployed in the world. Instead of clinging to the culture of Western society and America, we know that because our family members are serving, and because we're on a base where these things are coming to us, we have to be citizens of the world. You don't live in a country, you live on a planet. And that's something that I think contrasts people who live civilian life versus people who live a military lifestyle. And I think it makes a very interesting difference in perspective, because it made it very easy for me to identify with Eastern philosophy. And there are Eastern philosophy concepts that I use in my business model that make me competitive and disruptive to people who don't have that. And it's a worldview that lets me pivot in ways that are unpredictable to people who would quote unquote be my competition or who are studying me. They have no idea where this is coming from, but someone on the other side of the world sees it. But then that's balanced about against the fact that I grew up in the West, so I'm deploying it in a way, mm-hmm, that may not be beholden to the traditions of, or maybe even the structure or the history. I won't romanticize it in the way that someone who comes from that world does, which means that I get to use them their underlying philosophy in a tactical way that they may not, because of the emotional and historical relevance that they give it. And then from a Western perspective, it's something they wouldn't have even seen coming or thought of, because they're just not used to it.
Well, you that's well said. And I think you bring up a really important point, Roberto, that I think is worth kind of extracting and building on, which is, I think we've come kind of full circle to this issue of why branding is so important. Because sure, some people will replicate your process, and they will try to replicate certain things that I do, people already have. However, they cannot copy your knowledge, your point of view, your personality, the way that you speak, the way that all the things that make you you.
And they don't have your experiences that make that foundation.
They can't do that. So the one thing that's so important, why I think, you know, you and I talked a little bit earlier about personal branding and why it's so important, is that, you know, people will copy certain things, and some things are easily copied. However, somebody's personality, like, there's only going to be one Roberto Blake, right? That's you. And nobody can copy your personality, your intelligence, your sensibility, and combine all these different things in the way that you do it. So yes, to some degree, you know, we have to worry about people copying us, but I'll be honest with you. I mean, there's some things people can try to copy, but they don't have my knowledge, my experience, my years on stage, as well as in corporate America. They don't have my lens of the world. They don't have all these different things. And so that's hard to replicate. And that's, I think, why having that personal brand and really putting your lens and your spin on it becomes really important, because that stuff's hard to copy.
You know why I don't worry about like people copying me and why I put everything out there for free? Like a lot of our colleagues have actually said, hey, maybe you shouldn't put the slides, and you do such great slides, Roberto, maybe you shouldn't put all that stuff available on LinkedIn and SlideShare. Don't you think people are going to copy you or steal your slides or stuff like that? People are doing that to me and I'm just worried about you. And I go, well, first of all, the visual branding of my slides, the design of my slides is so unique to me. Uh-huh. And I also invest more in stock photography than everybody else in our space. Like I spend literally hundreds, if not thousands of dollars in stock photography. I also spend thousands of dollars in camera gear to shoot my own photos. And then I've paid hundreds of dollars for artists to commission artwork for me. So I have unique assets that are clearly Roberto Blake assets. So good luck with stealing that and passing it off as your own. But then I also have experience as a graphic designer that almost no one else in our space has. I made ads. I didn't just come up with copy and headlines. I actually did billboards for a living, right? So I have that schooling. I went to school for graphic design advertising. So that's different. And then the other thing is like, I'm not worried about it because they don't have my time and years on. They're not going to invest what I invested. They can't copy those things because it's too obvious and they wouldn't know what to do with it. But beyond all of that, even if they pulled all of that off, here's the thing. It was in the new Star Wars film. The villain, Supreme Leader Snoke, said something very interesting. He talked about the fact that greatness has to be crafted from the best materials. Yeah. And he was talking about Ben Solo, Kylo Ren, grandson of Darth Vader. And he was talking about, oh, your bloodline, you're this, you're that, you know, the greatest of raw materials to work with as my masterpiece. And so when I think about, you know, individual people and what makes people unique is you can take my blueprint, you can take my systems, you can copy me to your heart's content and you will lose because I'm crafted from different materials than you. You can have a great blueprint, but if the foundation is bad, whatever you build is going to break. It's going to collapse. It's going to fall in on itself because you don't have a solid foundation and because you're also skipping steps in many cases. And because no matter what I give you in terms of the blueprint, you don't necessarily have the raw materials that make me and have built my success. And I think that's true for everybody. I don't have the same raw materials. I don't have the experience, like you said, the years in comedy that you have. I don't have the 15 years plus you had in corporate. I had my time in corporate, which was, you know, significantly less, but I had my time. Mm-hmm. It was all it needed to be because that's the only reason I didn't kill myself. so the dark self-effacing human there, but absolutely true. So I think that those things all add up. I think that our experiences in life craft and mold and shape us, and those are unique to us. That's our experience. That's how we lived, and you can't replicate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said. That's it.
Kathy, your final thoughts on like the current state of corporate culture and social media, and also one piece of advice for the audience.
I think the good news, and here's what I'm really optimistic about, is I think that corporate culture is changing. I think we are about to see an implosion in a good way of corporate culture as it is. And I mean, there are companies out there that have a really agile, fun, human startup culture. I'm talking about the big companies that are a little stodgy. I think that wall is coming down. It has to.
What's your favorite example of a fun company?
Oh my gosh. Well, I think, okay. Zappos puts a premium on culture, but lately you're going to laugh. Chubbies, if I'll tell you, like Chubbies, go check out their Twitter feed. Okay, Chubbies makes me laugh. BarkBox. They do BarkBox. They do like stuff for dogs. Talk about a personality.
Yeah, I'm familiar with them. They're a subscription box model for dogs.
Yes.
Yeah.
BarkBox is great. And then Chubbies makes me laugh. Like their whole, because they know their audience. It's millennial men. They make, you know, shorts and casual wear, lifestyle wear. And, you know, they have such a personality and they're fun and they're different. And Beta Brand, it's also a clothing brand. They do outsourced design. And if it gets voted up, they make that piece of clothing. And they
I might have to check them out.
You've got to check them out. Their founder, Truth in Advertising, is a friend and their CEO. And my gosh, they're...
So I'm going to ask for an intro because now I'm fascinated. I'm doing that. I'm throwing that right hook to show the audience that like this is why having good relationships and this is where like extra value comes out of like a podcast, because it's like, now I'm going to throw this right hook and Kathy's going to make an intro to the head of a brand that now I'm fascinated by. See why you guys need to build a personal brand. You see, it's not about being a bottle of water, Cheryl. Like, it's about network is net worth and putting yourself out there.
Absolutely. It really, really is. It's getting out there. And so so these are fun brands. They have a personality, and that's the thing. They're just a lot of fun. And I think that that wall is coming down for bigger brands too, because I think what they're realizing is that, again, the boring tax, this doesn't work. The status quo does not work anymore. And if you don't change it, you're going to lose to the people who do. So I think we're going to see corporate culture kind of blow up in a good way. The walls are coming down. And I think what that means is, what I would say to every brand out there is, collaborate, build content with your audiences. We call it in performing and in improv, on the improv stage, we say, breaking that fourth wall. And what we mean is, you are talking to the audience talks back, you are developing together. So I don't think marketing can continue to create content and throw it at an audience. I really believe what people need to start thinking about now, so all the people listening, is how can you collaborate and co-create content with your audience? Can you create a story or game or interactive whatever to get your audience to participate?
And AKA user-generated content.
Yes, user-generated content, or at least co-created with you. It doesn't have to all be created by them. However, I really think the more you can get people to participate, we share what we create. We share what we create. And when you invite them to participate with you, whether it's your employees and your customers, they're going to share much more, you know, it's going to be more relevant and much more willingly when they create with you. So that's the advice I'd give. And I think that's a big prediction. And I can't tell you how excited I am that these corporate walls, this firewall, that marketing has erected between itself and the audience is coming down. And I'm very excited about it.
I'm super excited about that. I'll give you a practical example of how I'm going to implement exactly like what you said. I've been thinking about this. So, you know, I recently released that product, the YouTube Starter Kit for YouTube creators, people who are not great at Photoshop, people who need YouTube channel thumbnails that will get clicked on because they need the attention, but they suck at Photoshop or they suck at photography, and they just need to be able to put their text in or drop their photo in and call it a day. I made that product. One of the things I'm going to do is I'm going to encourage people who've already bought the product to start showing it off and showing what they did with it to improve their channel and what their results look like in the form of like some kind of like contest, if you will. And the people who do that very well will get a 30-minute free session with me where I'm going to review their channel. And if they want, I can do it with them in the form of a video that becomes like a piece of content that, you know, one, is value to my audience and also can show like how I do a review. So it's showing my skills, but it's also showing off what they managed to accomplish with my product. And then it rewards them. It encourages more people to buy, but then it's also us collaborating on a piece of content. They get to collaborate with someone that they might admire me as like a larger YouTuber in the space, you know, someone with over 250,000 subscribers. And that might actually, depending on it, like that doesn't necessarily drive traffic to people's channel. That's a misconception, but it could, or it could give them some other opportunity, because depending on what they're doing, maybe somebody hires them. Like, you know, there was a kid that got like 8 design clients because I was reviewing his channel in one of my live streams. And he was a designer on YouTube who had a channel about graphic design and art and hand lettering. So I think that that's a way for me, for example, to one, take something that people have already bought and reward that with another opportunity to have access to me for something that they would then have to normally pay for. Then they get to collab with me on a piece of content potentially if they do that. And then on top of that, they get to be showcased on my platform. So I think that it's a really practical way to do something that's not gimmicky, cost me next to nothing as a contest, rewards people who've already bought with me, and then encourages more people to do the same. And then also encourages people to hire me, because look at what value I can give and help give you context on how to execute, you know, on your YouTube channel if that's something you want, because I sell that as a service. So it's wildly practical when I lay it out like that, right? So for anybody out there, reverse engineer what I just said, because, you know, we talked in abstracts earlier. You want to get granular? I just gave it to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. That's a great way to put that into practice and make that real, that collaborative, interactive kind of content creation. I think that's a great way to get your audience to participate. And I think that's really what the next wave of great marketing is going to be, is that interactive sort of make your community, your content creators with you. And it's not just user generated content. It's making them feel a part of the brand. Yeah.
Absolutely. I think brands need to look at how to make their consumers part of the brand experience.
Mm-hmm. Well said.
Disney's good at it. Oh. Disney's good at it.
Boy, they set the high bar, don't they? I mean, and we can learn a lot. I think one of the things that's really important is that B2B can learn so much by looking at consumer brands. And, you know, Disney always sets a high bar for great experiences.
Who are your favorite three B2B brands?
That's always a challenging one because there's not as many as I would like. But I will tell you, you know who surprises me, who I wouldn't have said this, you know, 10 years ago, but they've come a long way. Intel has come a long way with storytelling.
Oh, God, yes.
They've come enough. They really have. They've done some funny things. They've done some really human things. And they've done some great storytelling. So Intel has come a really long way. I think Microsoft has come a long way. In fact, Microsoft set up a microsite dedicated just to stories of people who use Microsoft products to create arts and advanced science and do some amazing stuff in the world. They just happen to use Microsoft products, which is...
No, I agree.
It's fantastic.
They also did a creator initiative. Like, they actually did a creative initiative fairly recently, and they're actually working a lot more with Adobe lately.
Ah, I love that. No, I think that is really powerful. I think... Gosh, I think, you know, those are, I'd say there's a brand and I'm blanking on it. It's more of a consumer app, but it's in the finance sector and it's sort of one of those U-wallet kind of types. And they do, and I apologize, I'm blanking on it, but the name of it, but it's one of the things they really love, I love about them is that they have their channel content also includes like millennials running financial literacy programs. So they have a video. Ooh. They have a videos that they put out from millennials on how they bashed the heck out of their student debt, or how they use their credit cards to do something amazing, and how they
is it Stripe or is it Venmo or what?
Like, it's one of those, and it's one of those kind of wallet. I just can't remember the name of it, but it's, I'll look it up. I will look it up. But one of the things I was struck by is how they created content in such a compelling way. And what they do is they actually have on the road. So there's people who travel, and then from the road, they do these interactive shows and they'll bring a guest on who, has done something amazing, and how they financed it and how they did it or how they got out of debt. And they take people with real examples, teaching financial literacy, but also how they did something really amazing. So there's an entrepreneurial component to what they did. And it's really cool because without getting preachy or lecturing about FICO scores, they actually give really practical, fun advice. Then they actually had a guy on there. This is what he did, Roberto. He actually gave a whole thing on how to use a credit card to, if you're locked out of your car, how to use a credit card to cut up. Like if you're in a bar and you need to cut up, you know, your food, you can use a credit card to chop things up. And then he's like, all these things you can do with a credit card. And just fun, fresh, different segments. And I felt like they were using content in such a traveling momentum, giving up control and letting some of their users run their live streams way. It was phenomenal. It was really phenomenal.
No, I totally dig it. No, that sounds amazing. So, Kathy, you have a podcast. You have like amazing content that you put out. Where can my audience find you? We're going to link all of her stuff in the show notes, by the way.
Ah, great. Thank you. You can find me at keepingithuman.com. I've got a blog there. I've got my show right now. My live stream show is Yes And Brand Show, which some people will recognize Yes And being the principal tenet of improv. And I am about to relaunch my podcast. I had a podcast for 3.5 years and I'm sort of, I'm giving the baby a little bit of brand Botox, which sounds kind of creepy and weird, but it is a podcast we're talking about. So, but it's really sort of giving it an uplift. So look for that. And I'll keep you posted on keepingithuman.com. You can also find me on Twitter at Kathy Cloates Guest, no hyphen.
And of course, you can buy her book, which I highly recommend, Stop Boring Me, which is an amazing read. And again, it talks about how you can do storytelling, you can eliminate jargon, you can reach human people. And I think it's a fantastic thing to add to your book collection. It's in my top 100 books that built my business. So I definitely recommend a read. We'll link that down in the show notes. Kathy, always a pleasure talking to you. Thanks to you so much for being on the Create Something Awesome Today podcast. Guys, make sure that you're checking out the Create Something Awesome Today podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Google, and wherever podcasts can be found. And also remember, the Create Something Awesome Today podcast is currently sponsored by me. And so check out awesomecreatoracademy.com. That is my online group mentoring program. If you have never had an Obi-Wan, a Luke Skywalker, a Yoda to show you the way, we have over 100 great entrepreneurs that are hustling. It's a peer learning program. You get more access to me. We have monthly mastermind calls. You get exclusive content, case studies, and breakdowns. And we also have some other great products and services for you. So make sure you're checking that out. AwesomeCreatorAcademy.com. Heck, you can even hire me for one-on-one coaching through that platform if you want. Anyway, guys, that is it for our show. Thank you so much to Kathy for being a wonderful guest. Guys, just remember, go out there, create something awesome today. Take care.
This episode has ended, but your creative journey continues. Visit createsomethingawesometoday.com and access all links and resources mentioned in today's show, all designed to help you create something awesome today.